From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is a historic piece of legislation that marks, frankly, the end of neoliberalism that has governed America for the last four decades. It is a major investment in the American people.
Democrats are facing a pivotal week that could decide the future of President Biden's domestic agenda. We'll talk about the intense negotiations around the Build Back Better plan with Congressmember Ro Khanna. Then, as imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange prepares for an extradition hearing this week, we'll air highlights from a People's Tribunal calling for his release.
WikiLeaks and Julian, as we know, are being persecuted for revealing to the world, especially to liberals, Democrats, Tories, social Democrats, revealing to them the crimes against humanity perpetrated by our own elected leaders in our name, behind our backs. This is why they are now killing Julian Assange.
We'll hear former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, former British labor leader Jeremy Corbyn, NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, and others.
What is happening to Julian Assange is a crime, and he must be freed. If we're going to free the world, we have to free Assange.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, the military says it's placed Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok under house arrest in an undisclosed location and detained most of his cabinet members in what the information ministry is calling a coup. Sudan's military ruler has declared a national state of emergency and said he had dissolved a joint military-civilian governing council meant to transition Sudan to civilian rule. He said a new government would lead Sudan until elections in July 2020. This comes after a failed coup attempt last month and 2 years after a popular uprising and military takeover ousted the longtime President Omar al-Bashir. The internet went down across most of Sudan as tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets, blocking roads in Khartoum and facing gunfire near Sudan's military headquarters.
An urgent call to all Sudanese civilians who want to protect their revolution. What the military is doing is a betrayal to all civilians on all fronts. It is the duty of all civilians to move and to block all the roads outside to prevent any military force to move. Right now, all of us must unite to show the truth. It's to be or not to be, and we will.
A trove of internal documents turned over to federal regulators by the Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen is continuing to shed new light on the social media giant's role in spreading misinformation and polarizing content. A consortium of 17 news outlets examining the so-called Facebook papers have revealed how Facebook fueled hate speech and violence in India, helped foment the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol as well. The documents reveal most of Facebook's efforts to combat online hate are focused on the United States, with little investment in safety protocols for the rest of the world, which is the overwhelming number of its audience. One test account set up by Facebook managers to represent an average young adult user in India quickly became flooded with Hindu nationalist propaganda, anti-Muslim hate speech and incitements to violence. A Facebook staffer monitoring the account said, quote, "I've seen more images of dead people in the past 3 weeks than I've seen in my entire life total." Unquote. Another trove of documents reveals internal anger and regret at Facebook over the company's role in spreading the QAnon conspiracy theory and so-called Stop the Steal pages that helped fuel the violence at the U.S. Capitol January 6th. Today, Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen testifies to lawmakers in the U.K. as they consider an online safety bill. two planners of the pro-Trump rallies that preceded the U.S. Capitol insurrection have named multiple members of Congress who they say were intimately involved in planning both Trump's efforts to overturn his election loss and the events that turned violent January 6th. That's according to Rolling Stone, which names the representatives as Lauren Boebert, Mo Brooks, Madison Cawthorn, Andy Biggs, Louis Gohmert, Paul Gosar, and Marjorie Taylor Greene. Trump's White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, also reportedly played a major role in helping to plan the protests. Congressmember Gosar reportedly went as far as to promise a blanket pardon from the White House to encourage the rally planners to proceed with their so-called Stop the Steal rallies. In the occupied Palestinian territories, Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz outlawed six human rights groups, branding them, quote, terrorist organizations in the latest attack on Palestinian rights. The groups are Ahak, Adamir, Defense for Children International, the Bisan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees and the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The move allows Israel to raid and close the group's offices, arrest and imprison their staff, and ban their funding. This is Shawan Jabarin, Director General of Ahak.
An occupation that can do anything, occupation that kills children, destroy property and homes over the heads of the residents, that can raid and close offices. Yet the question is, how will we deal with this decision? We will continue to work and deliver our message using all means.
In other news from the region, Israel said it'll build 1,300 more units for settlements in the occupied West Bank. The settlements are illegal under international law. In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan ordered the expulsion of 10 foreign ambassadors in a sign of escalating tensions with Western powers.
You cannot dare to come to the Turkish Foreign Ministry and give orders here. I gave the necessary order to our foreign minister and said what must be done. These 10 ambassadors must be declared persona non grata at once.
Seven of the ambassadors are from NATO allies. The move came after diplomats from the U.S., Canada, Germany, France, the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Norway, and New Zealand issued a joint statement urging the release of jailed businessman and civil society leader Osman Kavala, who has been detained in pretrial since 2017 on charges related to the 2013 Gezi Park protests and a 2016 coup attempt. The United Nations is warning of possible mass atrocity crimes in Burma amidst reports that tens of thousands of troops are massing into relatively restive regions in the north and northwest. The UN Special Rapporteur for the region said the military government likely engaged in crimes against humanity and war crimes. According to a local monitoring group, nearly 1,200 civilians have been killed and over 7,000 arrested since protests erupted following February's military coup. In Libya, thousands of refugees have been camping outside a UN office in Tripoli, calling for the organization to evacuate them following massive raids and the arrests of some 5,000 migrants over the past month. Refugees are being indefinitely detained in overcrowded Libyan prison camps, which are plagued with accusations of human rights violations, including torture. Barbados has elected its first-ever president, who will replace the UK's Queen Elizabeth as head of state. Sandra Mason, Barbados Governor-General, received a two-thirds majority vote in Parliament last week. She'll be sworn in as president November 30th, the 55th anniversary of Barbados' independence from Britain. In Mexico, some 3,000 asylum seekers, mostly from Haiti and Central America, who've been trapped in the southern city of Tapachula, organized a caravan over the weekend and started trekking north towards Mexico City, with many hoping to reach the U.S. for refuge. The Mexican National Guard tried to block the caravan, but members of the group were able to break through the roadblock as some shouted Libertad, meaning freedom, liberty. Asylum seekers who fled extreme poverty, violence, and the impacts of the climate crisis in their home countries have been protesting a lack of aid, major delays in their asylum claims, restrictions on their movement, and human rights abuses. Indigenous advocates fighting to protect Oak Flat, a historic site in eastern Arizona, sacred to the San Carlos Apache Nation and other Native communities, argued their case against a proposed copper mine in federal court Friday. The legal efforts at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals are being led by the grassroots group Apache Stronghold. Native communities have long warned the massive copper mine would destroy Oak Flat, depriving them of their religious rights and other freedoms. This is Wensler Nosey Sr., founder of Apache Stronghold, former chair of the San Carlos Apache Nation.
We heard it loud and clear in Indian country that anything on federal land is not safe. Nothing is holy and nothing is sacred to them. That was clearly spoken. The emotionals that run through us is the fact that it answers the question that we are still prisoners of war in this country.
The copper mine is being run by the multinational corporation Resolution Copper, a joint venture of multinational mining corporations BHP and Rio Tinto. The Supreme Court Friday refused once again to block Texas' near-total abortion ban, but the court did agree to expedite their review of appeals to the nation's most restrictive anti-choice law, with arguments scheduled for November 1st. Justices will focus on whether the federal government is able to challenge the enforcement mechanism of the law, which deputizes private entities to sue anyone who either performs or, quote, aids and abets an abortion. Neera Tanden has been appointed as White House staff secretary, where she'll oversee which documents make it to President Biden's desk. Tanden was forced to withdraw her nomination to head the Office of Management and Budget in March over lack of congressional support after coming under fire from both the right and progressives. And more information's emerged about last week's deadly shooting of cinematographer Helena Hutchins on the New Mexico set of The Western Rust. Crew members say they made multiple complaints about safety on set, with two accidental discharges from prop guns occurring before the fatal shooting of Hutchins by Alec Baldwin, who was falsely told a prop gun was a cold gun, meaning unloaded, before he started rehearsing a scene. Corners were being cut, one person told the Los Angeles Times. The day of the shooting, all but two members of the camera crew reportedly walked off the job to protest working conditions. The departed crew members, who belonged to IATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, were replaced by non-union workers. Over the weekend, film workers in Albuquerque held a vigil for Helena Hutchins.
There are so many protocols when you're on set. It almost becomes a ceremony every time that you are handed a gun to use. Obviously, something failed, and I don't know what failed, but the fact that this happened shows that an elemental piece of that safety protocol didn't work.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, we speak to Congressmember Ro Khanna about the intense negotiations around President Biden's Build Back Better plan. Stay with us. By the Beatles. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After months of negotiations, Democrats are facing a pivotal week that could decide the future of President Biden's domestic agenda. Biden met with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Majority Leader Chuck Schumer at Biden's Delaware home Sunday in an attempt to advance the stalled reconciliation package that Manchin and fellow conservative Democrat Kyrsten Sinema have been obstructing. The proposed price tag on the Build Back Better Act, which would vastly vastly expand the social safety net and combat the climate crisis has already been slashed in half to $1.75 trillion, though the final cost is still being negotiated. Manchin reportedly agreed to some proposals on new taxes for corporations and billionaires, though no deal was announced following the meeting. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on CNN Sunday, Democrats are close to finalizing the measure, and the House is expected to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill later this week.
We've 90% of the bill agreed to and written. We just have some of the last decisions to be made. It is less than we had was projected to begin with, but it's still bigger than anything we have ever done in terms of addressing the needs of America's working families.
Progressive Democrats have worked to defend key provisions in Biden's infrastructure bill, like guaranteed paid family leave, which will reportedly be dropped from the proposal or cut from 12 weeks to just 4 weeks. On Saturday, Senator Bernie Sanders pushed back on reporting about cuts to an expansion of Medicare benefits, tweeting, "The expansion of Medicare to cover dental, hearing, and vision is supported by 84% of the public as one of the most important provisions in Build Back Better. It's what the American people want, and after waiting over 50 years, what they're going to get." Sanders added, "It's not coming out." For more on what could be final negotiations, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Congressmember Ro Khanna of California. Congressmember Khanna, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's a lot of numbers being thrown around, but let's talk about the specific measures. For example, the last one, adding the vision and hearing, and dental care to Medicare. Explain what exactly is being proposed and what are the cuts here.
Amy, Senator Sanders is absolutely right. This is actually the most popular part of the Build Back Better agenda. That's not an opinion. It's a fact if you look at the polling, and it's not coming out. We will push very hard to make sure it stays in. It's quite clear what it is. I mean, seniors right now have to pay thousands of dollars to get dental care. They can't afford to get hearing aids, and that comes out of pocket. They can't afford often the vision eyeglasses or things that they need to take care of their eyes. None of that is covered. And under Senator Sanders's plan, it would be covered. Now, the details are being negotiated, but I know that this is a top priority for the senator, and it's a top priority for House progressives.
And let's talk about paid family leave. Right now, not guaranteed at all. The proposal was for 12 weeks. It's now apparently been cut to 4 weeks, but could be actually nothing. Who is arguing that a person who gives birth should be back at work within a few weeks, if not the next day?
I don't know. Obviously, someone who is doesn't know anyone who's given birth. I mean, it's absurd to have it at 4 weeks. I mean, even, Amy, as you know, the Family Medical Leave Act allows 6 weeks. Now, that's unpaid, but that even that act, which passed under the Clinton years, allows for 6 weeks. So you would think at minimum we would cover 6 weeks. This is an area, again, where progressives are pushing very hard. We're saying do the 12 weeks, do what every other wealthy democracy, a wealthy nation does. Every other OECD country does. If you want to compromise on the number of years of the program, fine, we can compromise on that, but have a proper precedent in what should be paid parental leave, paid family leave.
So can you talk about the climate aspects of this bill? I know you're going to be holding congressional hearings. President Biden says he wants these bills signed off on before he leaves for Glasgow, the UN climate summit that's taking place there next week.
We need to do this, in my view, before the president goes to Glasgow to give him something to show American leadership. But if we're going to remove the climate energy program, that is the robust program of mandates and incentives to get us to 50% reduction by 2030, that's the president's goal. If we're going to remove that, we have to have an alternative to hit the president's goal. That is ongoing, that negotiation. Several ideas have been proposed: block grants to states, penalties for industrial polluters. So we have to look at what the package is. I know, though, that the Progressive Caucus has made it very, very clear. Jared Huffman, in particular, has been a great leader on this in saying we have to have the president's 50% targets met.
So talk about how these negotiations are going. You have Senator Manchin criticizing President Sanders' vision of America as an entitlement society. But in fact, is this really an ideological difference? The West Virginia senator making a fortune himself, founding coal companies in the 80s, his money now in a blind trust, his brothers and his son are all involved in that, largest recipient of oil, coal and gas money of the U.S. Senate. Is this purely about his own enrichment, that he is objecting to renewable energy, for example?
I wouldn't characterize it in that, those terms, but I would say that it's a philosophical debate. I mean, when you look at, I just look at my own life and what did America give me? I got to go to a good public school. I never had to worry about health care because my father had a middle-class job, but it had health care. I got to see a dentist because we had dental insurance. I got nutritious meals. I had access ultimately to a great education and was able to now take out loans for that. I paid them off, but I was fortunate. But my question, I guess, to people is, it doesn't seem that that's asking a lot. I don't think I'm a product of an entitlement society. I think I had basic education, health and nutrition that allowed me then to work and to make a contribution. And all Senator Sanders, all Build Back Better is saying is the opportunities that I had or so many in America have had should be available to all. That, to me, is a philosophical debate we're still having in this country. We're very close to getting it done, but we need to continue to make the case that investments in education and healthcare support productivity, support work, and aren't creating some welfare state as has been characterized.
So what is going to happen this week? The Progressive Caucus, the largest congressional caucus, has said they will not support passage of the bipartisan infrastructure bill, though they're not against that bill, unless at the same time the reconciliation bill is voted on. Do you actually see that happening this week? Enormous pressure on the Congressional Progressive Caucus. On the other hand, they're the ones that are putting the most pressure on keeping as much of the Build Back Better plan as possible.
We will not vote for the bipartisan bill, which has almost zero climate provisions, unless there is an agreed upon deal on the reconciliation bill. Now, there has to be sufficient specificity. There has to be a sufficient understanding that it's robust on climate, that Senator Sanders and the provisions he's been fighting for are in there. And I suppose if all 50 senators, including Senator Sanders and Senator Warren, are convinced that it will pass and are convinced that it's robust and have said that they will vote for it, of course, that will influence the progressive view. And the progressives then may say, OK, we have a deal. But it's important to realize that it's not just Manchin and Sinema. There's going to have to be the sign off of Senator Sanders, Senator Warren and other progressives in the Senate for the Progressive Caucus to feel assured that there is a deal.
Can you talk about the hearing that you're going to hold? The CEOs of six major fossil fuel companies and trade associations testifying this month, including ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Shell Oil, the American Petroleum Institute, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. What do you want to know from them about their role in spreading climate disinformation? And what do you think will be accomplished by your hearing?
It's a historic hearing, Amy. It's the first time these oil executives have had to come before Congress to answer for climate disinformation. The hearing is quite simple. It's first, why did you lie to the American people? And why do you continue to be deceptive about talking about all the challenges that climate change brings, that the climate crisis brings, but not taking action to address it. And we want to first expose that, expose the story of past misrepresentation and current ongoing deception. And then we need a commitment from them to stop all the misinformation, because you can't solve the climate crisis if you're going to have lobbyists and public relations firms and think tanks systematically putting out misinformation about climate.
You have reserved most of your animus on the Sinema Manchin blockade of this bill for Senator Sinema of Arizona. Can you talk about your concerns about her and why you're most critical?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's animus. It's just more bewilderment. And I guess my concern is the lack of transparency. You know, I disagree on a lot of things with Senator Manchin. But people have kind of had a sense of where he stands. And then you work and you negotiate. Senator Sinema, you know, doesn't ever do public interviews, doesn't talk to colleagues, doesn't talk to constituents. And so is operating in the sense where she just talks to the White House. And that has created a black box on what she wants, which has made it very, very difficult for the process to take place. And that is why I've had sort of the most frustration and criticism of her. It's not personal in any way. It's just, why is she not being more transparent?
So let's talk about how the bill was going to be funded and the issue of increasing taxes on corporations and billionaires and millionaires and those of the wealthiest classes in this country. You have 55 corporations, at least, that are paying zero taxes. What are you demanding? And what is Senator Sinema, who in the past has supported increasing taxes, now done 180 on?
Well, in the past, she voted against the Trump tax cuts. The Build Back Better bill would not even raise the tax rates back to where they were prior to the Trump tax cuts. They would just marginally raise the corporate tax rates and the taxes on the wealthy, and Senator Sinema is opposed to that. But I understand that Senator Warren is prevailing on this idea of a wealth tax, which I support. And if we're going to have a wealth tax on the billionaires, that's a good first step. And I understand that she's also managed to prevail on this view that every corporation should pay tax. I mean, it sounds silly to even say it, but right now you have over 50 companies, many very wealthy companies that pay zero tax. And I support that. So if we could get these provisions of a wealth tax, which frankly is even more progressive in my view than raising corporate tax rates, and a corporate minimum tax, and if that gets to the revenue we need, I'm open to that approach. And then we still, in my view, need to raise the corporate tax rates and raise the tax rates on the wealthy. And maybe we could do that in a subsequent bill. It's bewildering to me why Senator Sinema is opposed to that. But I'm for these other alternatives that are being floated.
Finally, Congressmember Khanna, you represent Silicon Valley, and I want to ask you about the social media giant Facebook. A consortium of 17 news outlets is examining the so-called Facebook papers, a trove of internal documents turned over to federal regulators by Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen, that are shedding new light on the role of Facebook in spreading misinformation and polarizing content. The documents reveal most of Facebook's efforts to combat online hate are focused on the United States. We're talking about the United States audience is like 9%, and something like 90% of the resources are spent on the U.S. when 90% of their audience is outside of the United States. As we reported in headlines, one test account set up by Facebook managers to represent an average young adult user in India quickly became flooded with anti-Muslim hate speech, Hindu nationalist propaganda, incitements to violence. A Facebook staffer said, "I've seen more images of dead people in the past 3 weeks than I've seen in my entire life total." You not only represent Silicon Valley, you are an Indian American. Can you talk about the significance of this and what you're demanding of your hometown multinational corporation?
Amy, I appreciated that view. I'm not just an Indian American, but as you may remember, my grandfather spent 4 years in jail as part of Gandhi's independence movement. So I'm an Indian American who believes that pluralism is key to democracies and key to India's best traditions. It's deeply concerning, and someone should look at the report that Muslim Advocates put out, Complicit, that talks about how some of the social media it was captured in places like India, in places like Myanmar, to have incitement of violence against minorities, where people from the government actually captured the regulatory processes at these social media companies. Obviously, Facebook needs to take remedial action and acknowledge what was wrong, but I think that you need actually legal remedies. I have proposed that the Alien Tort Act should be extended to allow people outside the United States to sue in the United States courts when there is speech that incites violence and mass human rights violations. There should be some recourse, because right now their only recourse is to the company itself, and the company itself in these overseas markets is often captured by bad interests. So whether it's in the United States courts, yeah, or international courts, I'm sorry for going too long. I just feel very passionate about this issue. There needs to be accountability and legal reform.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Congressmember Ro Khanna represents Silicon Valley in California. Coming up, imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange prepares for an extradition hearing. We'll hear from a tribunal calling for his release. Stay with us. Decide by the Julie Ruin. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is going to be back in a London court for an extradition hearing Wednesday. In January, a British judge blocked Assange's extradition to the U.S., but the U.S. appealed the decision. He faces up to 175 years in prison in the U.S. under the Espionage Act for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes. Assange has been jailed in England for 2.5 years. Prior to that, spent over 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy, where he had political asylum. On Friday, the Progressive International convened a gathering of the Belmarsh Tribunal, which is named after the prison where Assange is being held. The People's Tribunal is modeled on the Russell War Crimes Tribunal, which was formed in 1966 by Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre and others to investigate U.S. war crimes in Vietnam. We'll spend the rest of the hour airing excerpts from the Belmarsh Tribunal, beginning with the British writer Tariq Ali, who served on the Russell War Crimes Tribunal in the 60s.
Julian exposed another set of wars. Basically, he exposed the so-called war on terror, which began after 9/11, has lasted 20 years, has led to six wars, millions killed, trillions wasted. That is the only balance sheet of that war. Nowhere has it redeemed itself or done any good, as we've seen most recently in Afghanistan. So what do you say to people like Chelsea Manning and Julian, who's the principal target of the legal and judicial brutalities taking place, when they reveal stuff which everyone knows it's true, since some of it is on video? Americans bombing Iraqi families, totally innocent. Totally innocent. Laughing about it and are recorded killing them. That's a big joke. Well, it isn't a big joke for the millions who've died in the Arab world since these 20 years war began. And Julian, far from being indicted, should actually be a hero. He's not the first. And if they think that punishing him in this vindictive and punitive way is going to change people's attitudes to coming out and telling the truth, they're wrong. Julian is unfortunate to be captured by this particular state and its different apparatuses in order to appease the United States of America. He should never have been kept in prison for bail. He should not be in prison now awaiting a trial for extradition. He should be released, and I hope that acts like the Belmarsh Tribunal will help to bring that nearer.
Thank you, Tariq, and thank you for mentioning Afghanistan, which brings us directly to our next member of the Belmarsh Tribunal, which is Selahi Ghaffar, the spokesperson for the Solidarity Party of Afghanistan.
Dear comrades and friends, I'm thrilled and honored to join you on this historical tribunal. All Afghans, particularly the families of the war victims, expect the Belmarsh Tribunal to heal their wounds by holding the United States accountable for the thousands of innocent Afghans' lives they destroyed and the future they stole. And I salute the Progressive International for this remarkable initiative. In the wake of the U.S. humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan, everybody asks this question. How did the 2 decades of the U.S. military occupation of Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism ended with the Taliban terrorists gaining a swift and easy victory in Afghanistan? Well, so far, in my opinion, only one person by the name of Julian Assange possibly had the answer to this mystery. In 2011, he unmasked the truth through a set of documents called the Afghan War Diary, where he exposed the tyrannical U.S. policy in Afghanistan and said that one of the goals behind sustaining the war was to wash money out of the tax bases of the U.S. and Europe through Afghanistan and back into the hands of the transnational security elite. 2 decades of U.S. occupation brought us nothing but ruin and loss of lives. And while the mainstream media tried to portray a rosy picture of Afghanistan, the leaks by Assange and contrary revealed bloody atrocities committed by the U.S. and NATO occupying forces. For instance, in 2007, the U.S. Special Forces dropped 62,000-pound bombs on a compound where they believed a high-value individual was hiding. However, locals reported that up to 300 civilians had been killed in this raid. None of the media reported that incident. According to reliable sources, about 241,000 Afghans have been killed by crossfire between the U.S. forces and the Taliban, of whom 48,000 civilians have been killed by U.S. occupation forces in a number of unknown incidents. But in my belief, the real number is much, much higher, as many incidents are not reported and not documented. Well, the U.S. occupation has also inflicted invisible wounds. In 2009, the former Afghan Ministry of Public Health reported that fully 2/3 of Afghans suffer from mental health problems. The war has exacerbated the effects of poverty, malnutrition, poor sanitation, lack of access to health care, and environmental degradation on Afghans' health. Therefore, U.S. and NATO allies are responsible and accountable for all the past 20 years' misery of our tormented people, particularly our ill-fated women. Thank you again for giving me the opportunity to be among you all today in this tribunal, and I hope Julian Assange will be free soon. Thank you.
So from Afghanistan, we are back to Church House, the heart of Westminster, and I'm really glad that I can present the next member of the Belmarsh Tribunal, who is a member of UK Parliament, Jeremy Corbyn.
Julian Assange has paid a very, very, very high price for his lifelong determination to expose the truth. Why? Is it because he has some idea that he can make himself famous by exposing the truth? Or is it something much stronger and much more moral than that. The belief that by exposing the truth, you can save lives, you can stop wars, and you can make sure that democracies function properly by holding all public officials, elected or unelected, to public account. And that's why the role of Julian Assange in all of this is so important. His information exposed the dishonesty surrounding the claims on Iraq. His information exposed the dishonesty of the continuing reporting of Iraq after 2003, with hidden information about the numbers of people that had died from friendly fire in Iraq, but also the dangers to all journalists, to everyone who believes in free speech, of the concept of the embedded journalist, embedded on an aircraft carrier, sent into a barracks or whatever else, to produce reports that are to the liking of the military. So those of us who want to live in a peaceful world and do not believe that a repeat of Iraq will do anything other than bring about even worse consequences than the Iraq war did, are here because we want to support Julian Assange in the bravery that he's shown and the price that he's already paid for that bravery of ensuring that the whole world knows the truth about it.
Our next speaker is the former finance minister of Greece, currently a member of the Greek parliament and co-founder of the movement DiEM25, Yanis Varoufakis.
A young man in Australia a long, long time ago, well before we ever knew about WikiLeaks, had an idea. The idea of using Big Brother's technology to create a large digital kind of mirror to turn to the face of Big Brother, so as to enable us to be able to watch him watching us, a bit like turning the mirror to the face of the Medusa. WikiLeaks is based on that idea. I remember spending a very long night with Julian in the Ecuadorian embassy in Knightsbridge when he called upon me to help him decipher and transcribe a conversation between officials of the International Monetary Fund. Having spent in the previous year a very long time negotiating with them, listening to them on that tape that Julian had procured through WikiLeaks, through this blind digital postbox, was such a splendid experience. It was so liberating because I could suddenly hear with my own ears the very same officials effectively agreeing with everything that the good people of Greece were saying, that we were saying, that I had been saying to them. Now, of course, WikiLeaks has done far more important work than simply revealing that the International Monetary Fund knew that they were committing crimes against the Greek people and other peoples in Latin America and so on while perpetrating them. WikiLeaks and Julian, as we know, are being persecuted for revealing to the world, especially to liberals, Democrats, Tories, Social Democrats, revealing to them the crimes against humanity perpetrated by our own elected leaders in our name, behind our backs. This is why they are now killing Julian Assange. So our message as the Belmarsh Tribunal must not simply be one of support for Julian or a call to have him released. No, we are a tribunal. We are trying the criminals that are killing Julian as we speak for crimes against humanity, not just for the crime of slowly murdering Julian Assange. You're criminals, and we're going to pursue you to the end of the earth and back for the crimes you're committing all over the world against humanity, while also murdering slowly Julian Assange and other whistleblowers who are revealing your crimes.
The next one who will testify is a Pulitzer-winning journalist, someone who spent more than two decades at The Guardian. This is Ewan McCaskill, and I'm really glad that you joined the Belmarsh Tribunal.
Another whistleblower that I owe much to is Edward Snowden. I went to Hong Kong in 2013 with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, and spent over a week holed up with Snowden in a hotel room in Hong Kong. Whistleblowers are essential to good journalism. They allow reporters to get behind the walls of secrecy, the walls of secrecy built up by officials and press officers. The whistleblowers reveal abuses and wrongdoing within governments, companies, the military, intelligence agencies. These whistleblowers should be rewarded for their courage. Instead, too often they end up facing prosecution or jail. There's been a war being waged against journalism and free speech, and it's been going on since at least 9/11. It's not a general war. It's a specific to national security and the intelligence agencies. The intelligence agencies are waging it to try and dissuade future leakers within the agencies and try and dissuade the journalists covering the national security beat. And this is what Assange has been caught up in. What Assange has been accused of is fundamentally no different from the normal interaction between whistleblowers and journalists on the national security beat. There's no fundamental difference between what Julian Assange was doing and what I was doing. When I was in Hong Kong with Snowden, I spent a week with him discussing the ins and outs of his work at the National Security Agency. I spent a week going through tens of thousands of secret documents. He passed me a memory stick with tens of thousands of secret documents on it. I mean, how is that fundamentally different from the relationship between the whistleblower Chelsea Manning and the publisher Julian Assange? If Julian is to be prosecuted, then there's an equally good case for the editor and journalist in The Guardian or New York Times, Der Spiegel, El País, La Repubblica, and all the other organisations involved in this coverage being prosecuted too. Obama, in spite of his liberal background, failed to stand up to the pressure from the intelligence agencies. He used the draconian 1917 Espionage Act and other laws against whistleblowers and journalists. In fact, Obama was responsible for more prosecutions and action against journalists and whistleblowers than all the other presidents in the US combined.
Our next member of the tribunal is the partner of Julian Assange and member of his defense team, Stella Morris. Thanks a lot for being today with us.
Thank you. We're meeting 5 days before Julian's, before the US appeal at the High Court here in London. And I want to remind everyone that Julian won the case on January 4th, and the Trump administration, 2 days before leaving office, lodged the appeal. And Julian's bail application was refused, so he's been in prison, in Belmarsh prison, for over 2.5 years. In the last few weeks, the mask has fallen in relation to the case against Julian. It's fallen because there was an article, well, it's been progressively falling over the years. There is no case, as others have said. This is just a naked political persecution. But there was an article published by Yahoo News just a few weeks ago, a 7,500-word investigation with over 30 sources, named and unnamed, high-level sources from current and past U.S. administrations, from the National Security Council, from the CIA. And that story revealed that the extrajudicial assassination of Julian in London was discussed at the highest levels of the US government. That the seventh floor of the CIA in Langley, which is the director's office, requested sketches and options for how to kill Julian inside the embassy of Ecuador. They talked about kidnapping him too, about rendition, rendition, extraordinary rendition, which is what the CIA developed to kidnap people and take them across jurisdictions to disappear them and then put them in a black site somewhere. And the embassy was essentially a black site towards the end. I felt that anything could happen there. Julian's lawyers were targeted by name, not just incidentally spied on. There are emails telling the security company to target Gareth Pierce, to target Aitor Martinez, to target Julian's legal team. And their documents were stolen. And Baltazar Garzon's office was broken into, just as the CIA was planning to murder Julian. And our six-month-old baby's nappy was instructed to be stolen so that they could use that, analyze the DNA to check whether Julian was the father. This is flagrant criminality. We're dealing with criminals who have instrumentalized the law, instrumentalized the extradition arrangements with this country and their good relationships with this country to politically persecute an innocent man, a journalist, for doing his job.
Thank you so much. And now the moment has come to greet a great guest, a member of the tribunal, who is joining us live from Moscow. This is Edward Snowden. I'm sure we don't need more introduction who he is. I think everyone knows who he is. And I'm really thankful, Ed, for joining us today and raising your voice at the Belmarsh Tribunal.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's difficult to be here. I struggle to understand how we can be here after so many years. There have been so many stories told. There's been so much criticism. There has been so much deception. And where has it brought us? Has this been constructive? Is this a victory for us, for the state, for humanity, for our rights? When I came forward in 2013, I said the reason that I came forward was that we have a right to know that which is done to us and that which is done in our name by our governments. That was already under threat. And when you look at the world since, it seems that that trend is accelerating. Do we still have that right? Do we have any rights if we don't defend them? Well, today we see someone who has stood up to defend that right, who has aggressively championed that right at an extreme cost. And it's time for us to defend his rights. What we're witnessing is a murder that passes without comment. And I want to say that it is difficult for me to comprehend the spectacle of the press of a nation or the developed world aiding and abetting with full knowledge a crime not only against this man, but against our public interest. However, at this moment, that we all see this, we all feel it. It's no less familiar than the shoes on my feet. Everywhere we look, from Afghanistan to economics, from pandemic to pervasive surveillance, the obvious has been made unspeakable. It has become unspeakable because the truth of our circumstances could be taken as evidence in the defense of the actions of the outer favor. And in the eyes of the American state, few represent this class a greater object of hatred than the person of Julian Assange. He has been charged as a political criminal, something that I understand quite well, but he has been charged as the purest sort of political criminal for having committed the transgression of choosing the wrong side. The charges, which are they are absolutely an unadorned legal fiction. We are told to believe that the state has these powers over what can be said and what can't be said, the things that can and cannot be said. But what happens if we permit that? Where does that lead? What are we? Can we be said to be free? If even our power to express ourselves, to understand the facts of our world, can be fenced off from us, and we look beyond through the gauze, through the veil, at what could be the facts of the world, but we're not permitted to acquire them. Julian Assange did not accept that. And the charges against him reduced to an allegation to commit the crime of journalism in the first degree. Which is to say, when we look at it applied elsewhere, the same sort of publication of classified material that we see in the New York Times or the Washington Post, aggravated by a conspiracy to accomplish the same, which is simply uncovering an uncomfortable truth. But something distinguishes Julian Assange from the greatest newspapers of our day, and that is his independence. Julian Assange is not a person who will be told no lightly. I remember in the case of 2013, when I came forward and revealed evidence of mass surveillance, which the government of my country had constructed the apparatus of mass surveillance, an entire scheme that spanned the globe, with the participation of Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and of course, the United Kingdom. And when the newspapers of all of these countries began publishing these things, one of the papers who held the archive of material originally included The Guardian, who was headquartered in the United Kingdom, still is. And I remember reading a story. Of course, I wasn't there for it personally. I'm getting this secondhand. Who knows what we can rely on, the state of journalism as it is today. But they were approached by the British state, who said, okay, you've had your fun, you've done enough, now it's time to stop. And they had to send their archival material away to the United States, to a partner publication, because they no longer believed that they were safe to continue publishing. And they were right. Agents of the British state went to The Guardian. They destroyed their laptop computers. They've got it on film, putting angle grinders to computer chips, trying to erase any trace that these stories had been written from within the confines of the newsroom. Now, Julian was not deterred by that, and he never would be. When you perform the level of surveillance against a person that has clearly been performed and is being performed, even today, certainly in prison, against Julian Assange, you understand at least something about that character. You understand what the breaking point is. You know what it'll take to make them bend. And he didn't bend. He will break before he does. He has consistently and continuously dared to speak the unspeakable in the face of opposition, in the face of power, and that is a remarkable and rare thing. That is the reason that Julian Assange sits in prison today. If you love the truth, as I think everyone here does, you wouldn't be listening to this, you wouldn't be watching this, you wouldn't be participating in this, you wouldn't care about this unless something in you told you that something important was happening here. And if you do care, as I think you do, you are a criminal of the same category as Julian Assange. In the eyes of the state, what differentiates you, what divides you from him, is only the degree. We share the same guilt. Each of us share in the crime, and we are unindicted co-conspirators. In his quest to raise a lantern in the halls of power.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden speaking Friday from Moscow at the Belmarsh Tribunal in London, named for the Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison where Julian Assange is being held. The tribunal, organized by Progressive International, will link to the full event at democracynow.org. An extradition hearing for Julian Assange will be held on Wednesday. Special thanks to Navarra Media. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.